Ruth chapter 3. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you, where you'll be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do." "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized, and he said, "No one must know that a woman has come to the threshing floor." He also said, "Bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out." When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, "How did it go, my daughter?" Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her, and added, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today." It's an interesting passage. Before I preach on that, though, Mark's chosen a hymn, which we'll sing. I think it's on the sheet of paper you've got somewhere. "Speak, O Lord, as we come to you to receive the food of your holy word." Let's stand and sing. So begins one of the greatest love stories of all time. But of course, it soon becomes clear that the driving force behind the novel is not so much the man being in want of a wife, but the mother being in want of a husband for her daughter. She wants stability, status, and the only way she can find it is by finding a husband for her daughter. But if, when you read Pride and Prejudice, or maybe watched it on the TV, maybe you thought it was full of outdated customs that you can't really understand, well, wait until you read this chapter. Much like Mrs. Bennet, Naomi has a plan and is convinced the solution is marriage. See, Naomi's problem is that Ruth has pledged herself to her. And while it's a selfless act to be celebrated, it's kind of put Naomi in a difficult spot. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you'll be provided for." You see, the footnote says that home is literally rest, which is what Ruth gave up in chapter 1 to go with Naomi. If you look at chapter 1, verse 9, it says, "May the Lord grant each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Ruth gave that up to be with Naomi, and now Naomi feels like she needs to provide rest for Naomi. But she can't. She's an elderly lady. She can't go out to work. Now, the book of Ruth is very well structured. I kind of see it as a like 4-episode mini-series, and the episodes are a bit like EastEnders. You get the story, and then at the end, there's some cliffhanger that makes you want to tune in next week. So chapter 1, you get bereavement to bitterness, and then right at the end, the harvest was beginning. There's a few little green shoots. Chapter 2, you get bitterness to blessing, but then, see that last sentence? "And she lived with her mother-in-law." It's got nothing to do with the story, but it's making you think that this isn't really sustainable. We've got to do something about this. So it makes you wonder what's going to happen in the next chapter. Well, Naomi has a solution to the problem. And the solution is in the shape of a man named Boaz. Naomi says, now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Ruth's been working with Boaz for a number of weeks now. It seems some time has passed between these two chapters. And Naomi's noticed it. And she's noticed that Boaz seems to be a good man, a godly man. You can tell that from what he says and how he acts. And she's thinking, well, Ruth's single. Boaz seems to be single. He's a godly man. He's got a good job. What more do you want? And like a good mother-in-law, she has a plan. She's going to set them up. And she's got the right, she's picked her time as well. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Actually, it seems like time was probably running out, because you'd winnow the barley at the end of the harvest season, which would mean that the time for Ruth to go and work with Boaz would be running out. They might not see each other again. Naomi has to act now. If you're wondering why you would thresh the barley in the evening, apparently you need wind to do the threshing, because you throw it up in the air and the chaff gets blown away and the grain falls to the ground. But during the day, in that time of year, the wind would have been too strong. It would have blown the grain away as well. So you do it in the evening when the winds are lighter. There you go. Random fact I learned. Anyway, Naomi has a strategy. But it's not quite what you'd expect. Verse 3, wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do. Does that ring some alarm bells in your mind? Do you think, it's not really what I would advise my daughter to do if she wanted to find a husband? When Jade and I started dating, quite a long time ago, over 10 years, a friend of ours now, but he was a youth leader at the time, he suggested I read a book called I Kiss Dating Goodbye. I think he was hinting at something, but I ignored that, obviously, as a teenager would. But it's a book about problems with modern dating. It was written by a 21-year-old, which is probably not a good idea. But it does have some useful things to say, I think, on what's wrong with dating. He says that, you know, everyone goes in from serious relationship to serious relationship to serious relationship, and it's not really getting them prepared for marriage at all, it's just getting them prepared for divorce. I see that. But then he says that instead, we shouldn't date at all. We should have a more biblical model. We should do what people did in the Bible, which is courting. See, I have a problem with this more biblical approach, because the way people dated in the Bible is kind of like this. I don't think the point here is that you're supposed to do what they did. I don't think you're supposed to go and find someone at a threshing floor and go and sleep at his feet. These kind of passages are descriptive, not prescriptive. It's interesting, isn't it? So, for example, that first bit of verse 3, wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. What's Naomi doing there? Why does she say that? Well, maybe it's that Boaz has been working out in the field with Ruth. Ruth's been in her work clothes. She's been hot and sweaty. She's, you know, probably didn't look that attractive. So she says, well, you know, wash, put on perfume, put on your best clothes. Although there is another interpretation, because apparently the word best doesn't really appear in the Hebrew. The NIV just adds it because it thinks it makes sense. But the other interpretation is that Ruth has been still dressed in her mourning clothes since her husband died. So Boaz wouldn't have approached her, because he's an honourable man and you can see that she was sad. So Naomi's saying, come on, it's time to move on now. Take off your mourning clothes, put on your best clothes, go out to the field. Whatever it means, it's all a bit weird, isn't it? A bit weird and questionable. You know, dress up to attract Boaz, wait until he's had a few drinks, take off the covers, lie down. He'll tell you what to do. It's just not what you'd advise your daughter to do, is it? But I don't think that's what this passage is here for. It's not here to teach us how to find a husband. And I think, probably, it's generally bad advice. But that's not really the point of this chapter. We saw the same sort of thing in chapter 1, where Naomi and her husband go out to Moab, and the narrator never criticises it, but you kind of think it was probably a mistake. I think it's the same thing here. This is probably unwise advice, but that's not really the point of the chapter. I think, as far as the narrator's concerned, at least Naomi has a plan. She has a strategy. I think chapter 3 is an application of chapter 1 and 2, really. In chapters 1 and 2, we saw that God is in control of everything. He rules the world by his providence, his loving, fatherly care. And therefore, in chapter 2, we see Ruth coming up with a plan to get on and do something. Because you can, if God's in control. In chapter 2, Naomi was fitter and sitting at home, not wanting to do anything. But by chapter 3, Naomi's got a plan as well. She's woken up. She wants to do something. I think this is generally a good thing, right? If we want something to happen, we have to be willing to work for it. You know, in Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth doesn't just sit there until husband comes along. She actually does some stuff. I think. I only vaguely remember it. If you want to find a partner, you can't just like sit at home and wait for them to knock on your door, can you? You have to actually go out and meet some people. Or maybe sign up to some online service. I don't understand these things. Faith takes the first step, doesn't it? Faith does something. God doesn't usually give us instructions for what to do, though. He expects us to come up with a plan ourselves. Which raises a problem. Because what if someone else comes up with a plan and it's terrible? That's kind of what's happened here, isn't it? But I think sometimes we worry a bit too much about the wisdom of a certain plan, where maybe God would rather we just get on and do something. I'm not saying we shouldn't consider the wisdom of it or not, but there's a kind of attitude sometimes, I think, that we can, you know, say someone presents a new idea for some evangelistic opportunity, and we spend a lot of time thinking, well, actually, in this course, in week 3, it kind of phrases this thing quite unhelpfully. I don't think we should be doing this. Or, you know, I don't really like the language in that. Maybe that's not the right thing to do. And if you build that up, you end up just saying no to everything because you think it's not a very good idea. But surely doing something would have been better than doing nothing, right? Maybe we sometimes try and be more perfectionist than God. Obviously, God is perfect, but he's willing to use imperfect human beings to achieve his purposes. So maybe we should as well. This is not saying that we should not be wise. I'm sure Dad will do some more Proverbs and tell us that wisdom is a good thing. But it's against a kind of fake wisdom that just criticises everything and says no to it without ever actually doing anything itself. Look, whatever plan someone comes up with, it can't be as bad as Naomi's plan. And that worked. So how does Ruth respond then? We've seen Naomi's proposal. What's Ruth's proposal? Well, Ruth actually proposes. Ruth responds by, verse 5, doing everything her mother-in-law says. I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. The more I read this book, the more I think Jay's mum really likes it, but there we go. See, Ruth is willing to take advice from her mother-in-law, isn't she? I mentioned that book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, earlier, and I'm not a massive fan, but I don't think it got everything wrong. So one of the things it said you should do is, if you want to go on a date with a girl, you should go and ask her father if you're allowed to. Which I just think is a bit odd. If someone's like 30, like, why would you do that? Just go talk to them, go out for coffee, stop being weird. But the principle that you should listen to advice from friends and family is probably quite sensible. I mean, if you're dating someone and both your parents are convinced they're terrible, maybe there's something you're not seeing. If all your friends hate your boyfriend, it's a bit suspicious. Ruth is willing to listen to advice from Naomi, isn't she? She does what she's told. She washes, perfumes, dresses. She goes to the threshing floor, which is actually quite a risky thing for her to do. There'd be lots of men there and lots of drinking probably in the evening. You can see in verse 14, the second half, that women weren't allowed on the threshing floor. Which is not, I mean, that's true, but it's not quite how it worked, because especially in this time in Israel, whereas we've seen from Judges in previous weeks that things were pretty bad. And actually, in the nations around Israel, there were lots of women at the threshing floor. They were just all prostitutes, because they had these kind of fertility rituals. And it would have been quite risky for Ruth, especially as a Moabite, to turn up at the threshing floor. She's not going to do her reputation a lot of good, especially when she starts uncovering Boaz's feet and lying down next to him. Ruth then takes a big risk. But it's worth it, isn't it? Ruth realises that she's in need. She needs someone. And Boaz is her only hope, for security and rest and a home forever. She realises Boaz is her only hope, so she grabs hold of it with both hands. I wonder if you can see where I'm going here. We know that Jesus is our only hope, don't we? He's our only hope of being redeemed, our only hope of finding rest forever, a home that we can go to be with him. So we must grab hold of him with both hands. We must risk everything to get him. Jesus talks like this quite a lot, doesn't he? If you remember the parable of the the man who discovered treasure in a field and goes away and sells everything he has so that he can buy the field. He risks everything, gets rid of his entire life just to have that. The risk is worth it if the reward is Jesus. I was thinking that in the song we sung earlier. All I once thought gain, I have counted loss compared to knowing Jesus. But also, once we've been saved, we must take risks again. There's a little book here. When I say little, it's very little. It's only 65 pages. It's really the chapter of another book by John Piper called Risk is Right. You can buy it from £1 from 10 of those. On the back it says, a choice lies before you. Either waste your life or live with risk. Either sit on the sidelines or get in the game. Some people, though, don't really like risk, do they? There's these people at work called risk managers. Now, you might think what their job is to identify all these like really risky new opportunities that could bring us lots of benefit and say, go for it. But no, that's not what a risk manager does. A risk manager tells you why all the things you want to do are very risky and you really shouldn't be doing them. I think that their ideal world is one in which everyone in the office is sitting at the desk twiddling their thumbs because then nothing could go wrong. They won't like that, but it's true that lots of people don't like risk, isn't it? Jade and I have slightly different views of what kind of house we should be buying. I don't know. I'll leave you to see which one's which. But anyway, God wants us to take risks. And I think we can prove that, because as we've seen in previous chapters of Ruth, God is in control of everything that happens. He has a plan, but he doesn't tell us what that plan is. And yet he expects us to do things. So we have to take risks if we're going to achieve anything. But we have to take risks for the right motive. Not because we want to get riches or fame or fortune or anything like that. Piper says, the power and the motive behind taking risks for the cause of God is not heroism, or the lust for adventure, or the courage of self-reliance, or the need to earn God's goodwill, but rather faith in the all-providing, all-ruling, all-satisfying Son of God, Jesus Christ. The strength to risk losing face for the sake of Christ is the faith that God's love will lift up your face in the end and vindicate your cause. The strength to risk losing money for the cause of the gospel is the faith that we have treasure in the heavens that cannot fail. The strength to risk losing life in this world is faith in the promise that he who loses his life in this world will save it for the age to come. Because actually, risk is safe, isn't it, for the Christian? We know that nothing bad can ever ultimately happen to us. We may die, but not a hair on our head will perish, Jesus said. I think it's kind of like, you know those high ropes which they like string between trees and you can go wander along. It's really scary because you think you're walking on this tightrope thinking you might fall and there's like 50 feet to the bottom or something. But it's not really scary because you're strapped in. You've got a cord. It will hold you. Even if you fall, you won't actually fall. You'll be held. I think it's like that in the Christian life, isn't it? We can, maybe as a church, we're often scared to take risks. We think, oh, I know that there needs to be a church planted in that town and we could send 5 people, but what would happen to our church? It's not safe, is it? Or we think, oh, we could send loads of money to that church who needs to buy a building, but what about if we don't have enough money? It's just not safe. We can be unwilling to take risks, but really, what have we got to lose? Ruth here steps away from the tree, doesn't she? She's willing to take the risk. She doesn't just follow Naomi's detailed instructions for what she's supposed to do. She also says something of her own. I don't know if you notice that down in verse 9. Naomi didn't tell her to say this, but she says, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. What does that mean then? Well, apparently, it's an idiom for, essentially, I want to marry you, but without explicitly asking for it, because Boaz would be doing that later. But also, the corner of your garment is literally the wings of your garment, which I don't know if that reminds you of chapter 2, verse 12, where Boaz prays, doesn't he? He says, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. As I said, I think chapter 3 is an application of what we've already learnt in chapter 1 and 2. We learnt that Ruth is safe because God has sheltered her under his wings. God will provide for her. And we also learn that the way God provides for people is through others. God provides one person and they provide for someone else. It seems that Ruth here is kind of implying to Boaz that answer your own prayer. God's given you the means to protect me, so protect me. That's how it generally works, isn't it? God provides for us through others. But that doesn't get us away from the most obvious reading of uncovering someone as they're in bed, going to lie down next to them, and then basically saying, pull the covers over me. It's a bit weird, to say the least. In fact, there's so many slightly dodgy things in this passage. There's the, you know, the perfume, the clothes. Ruth's not to let Boaz know that she's there. Why is that? Boaz has been eating and drinking. He's in good spirits, it says, or merry, as some translations say. He's not drunk, I don't think, but he's had a couple of drinks, you assume. And that kind of phrase is mentioned three times in the terrible story at the end of Judges 17 to 21 that we were talking about last time. Why is it here? And then uncover. The word uncover in the Old Testament is used often to uncover the nakedness of someone, which is a euphemism. And the word feet as well. Apparently, it's in Hebrew, that could mean kind of the whole legs, really. I think it's like in football. I discovered this. That handball is not just when the ball hits your hand. It's also like when it hits your elbow, which doesn't really make any sense because that's not your hand. But apparently, that's the same kind of thing in Hebrew, that feet could be anywhere up to the legs, really. It's all a bit weird. And lie down next to him and basically do whatever he says. And then here she's saying, you know, pull the cover over me. Why? It's weird. Especially in a book so full of loveliness as Ruth. Isn't it rather lowering the tone? You know, Ruth shines like a gem against the black backdrop of Judges, especially chapters 17 to 21 that I mentioned last time, which are all set in and around Bethlehem. Then you get to Ruth, and so far Ruth has been shining brightly. So I think I said last time it's an ethical oasis in the wilderness of Judges. So why ruin it in chapter 3 with all these suggestive words and this slightly suspicious encounter at midnight? The author didn't have to write this in, did he? If the author's writing a genealogy of David, which I think he is, why say all this? I mean, it might have happened, but you don't need to say it, do you? You could just say, oh, they met and they fell in love and they all lived happily ever after. Why say all of this? Well, there's a few suggestions. One is that the author is dancing around the fact that they blatantly slept with each other, because he's kind of embarrassed to put that in the history of King David. But that can't be true, because Boaz is described as a man of standing in chapter 2, verse 1, and Ruth is described as a woman of noble character in verse 11. They're actually both the same phrase, just with masculine and feminine. It can't be that. No, there must be another reason. Now, one commentator says that the author here is trying to portray the inner feelings of the characters. Apparently, in ancient Hebrew literature, you never really get told what people are thinking, because they just didn't really have the concept of doing that. They didn't have like a narrator that knew people's minds. So instead, what the authors did was use words to kind of make you feel the same way they were feeling. So you feel really awkward and like there's quite a lot of tension here, because that's what they would have been. Maybe. But there's one more idea, which I really like, which I actually saw earlier in the year on a Twitter thread from James Bajon, I think. He's a researcher at Tyndale House in Cambridge. He says, and this sounds a bit obscure at first, but I think it's true. He says, the answer lies in Ruth's connections with the stories, on the one hand, of Judah and Tamar, and on the other, of Lot and his daughters. Now, I was glad I was doing this in the evening, because I don't want to explain all this in the morning. But do you think that's a bit random? Well, I don't think it is. If you look in chapter 4, verse 18, the genealogy of David starts with Perez. Now, why would you do that? Perez is like the first non-famous person in the genealogy. Why start with Perez unless you're making a point? What's the point? Well, if you go back up to verse 12, this is a very weird blessing. May your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. I don't know if you remember the story of Tamar and Judah, but that's not the kind of story you'd want to bring up in front of a little baby. Judah had two sons, Er and Onan. Er was killed by the Lord for his wickedness, and Onan refused to perform his duty to sleep with Er's widow, Tamar, to give her a son, so he was killed too. Judah didn't like the look of where this was going, so he didn't allow Tamar to marry his third son. So Tamar took off her widow's clothes, dressed up nicely, covered herself up, and tricked her father-in-law Judah into sleeping with her by pretending to be a prostitute. And the child she bore was Perez. Okay, so that's that story. What about Moab? Lot and his daughters. Well, Lot's daughters, their husbands were killed in Sodom and Gomorrah. So his daughters decided they needed children, so they would get their father drunk and wake him in the night and sleep with him to get pregnant. And the older daughter had a son called Moab. And I don't know if you've noticed in this book, but Ruth is repeatedly described as from Moab, far more times than is really necessary. You kind of got it the first time, and it repeatedly says, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite. Why? I think the author wants us to have that story in mind. So we're thinking really of three couples, thinking of Boaz and Ruth, and then on the one hand, Judah and Tamar, and Lot and his daughter. And the situations are remarkably similar, actually. So one, in all three stories, the characters leave their homeland. Judah leaves Egypt for Canaan, Lot leaves Abraham for Sodom and Gomorrah, Naomi leaves Israel for Moab. Two, in all three stories, the men die young without children, which three means that there's a crisis that endangers the family name. And then four, in all three stories, a woman decides to take matters into her own hands in order to preserve her family line. And more specifically, in all three stories, she decides to conceal her identity and approach the nearest available male. Tamar covers herself with a veil and waits for Judah to pass by. Lot's daughters approach him under the cover of darkness. And Ruth kind of does both, actually. And then five, in all three stories, the men have had something to drink. Judah's been at a festival. Lot's been plied by wine by his daughters. And then Boaz is in good spirits as Ruth approaches him. And that means that none of the men in these stories are aware of who's approached them. And sixthly, in all three stories, the man belongs to an older generation. Obviously, Judah is Tamar's father-in-law. Lot is the father of his daughter. And Boaz seems to be older than Ruth. That's why he keeps referring to her as his daughter and saying, you could have gone after one of the young men. So that gives us some background as to why the author would include this language. But it doesn't really make us any less nervous when we read it, does it? What's going to happen? Is this going to be a story of history repeating itself? Or might we go somewhere else? The stories do start off very similar, but how will they end? I was kind of thinking when I was reading this story of all of the Me Too hashtag stuff that's been going on in the last couple of years. This kind of sounds a little bit like an actress going up to a producer's hotel room. Her intentions are honourable, but you just know this is not going to end well. How will Boaz respond? Well, thankfully, Boaz is not like Harvey Weinstein. When Boaz sees Ruth, he says, "Who are you?" And the honourable reply comes back, "I am Ruth." She's not trying to conceal her identity. She's not trying to hide. The ball's then back in Boaz's court, who responds in an equally honourable fashion. "The Lord bless you," he says. He's amazed by Ruth's kindness. He's even saying it's greater than her first kindness, that of coming back to Israel to look after Naomi. Well, what's so great about it? He says, "You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." You get the impression that Boaz is probably a relatively older farmer, maybe not particularly attractive, whereas Ruth is young and probably quite attractive. I was saying this is a bit like someone as young and beautiful as Jade going after someone... I'm not going to finish. Anyway, Boaz is amazed by Ruth's character. She's a woman of noble character, he says in verse 11. Actually the same phrase as the wife of noble character in Proverbs 31 and Proverbs 12. It's only three times that's used. And he says that everyone in the town knows it. Literally everyone at the gate, which foreshadows chapter 4. But anyway, Boaz is amazed by Ruth's character, but we are amazed by Boaz's character. Not only in not sleeping with Ruth, which, given, as I said, that what was going on in Israel at that time, it's probably what the average Israelite waking up in the threshing floor and seeing a woman approaching them would think to do. But not Boaz. But also, in verse 12... You might imagine Ruth's heart sinking when she hears this. "Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I." Boaz clearly wants to marry Ruth in this story. He's really eager to get it all sorted as soon as possible. But he wants to do the right thing. He knows that someone else has first claim to the land, so he's going to do what's right. And then he's concerned for Ruth's safety, isn't he? He says, "Stay here for the night." And interestingly, he uses a word that doesn't mean lie down in bed for the night. It means kind of stay in this, like sleep in this house, but not in the same bed. He's concerned for her honour as well. He preserves her reputation. He provides her food, which I think is both being generous, but also providing her with a convenient alibi, because if she was going away from the threshing floor with a handful of grain, people would just assume she's gone to get some grain. It's interesting. What a change, then, from our fears as the scene was being set up. And what a change from what we feared might happen when you remember the story of their two ancestors. These people weren't defined by their past. Our past doesn't have to define us. We have a choice, don't we? We can do the right thing, even if all of our ancestors have done the wrong thing. We've said that Ruth is a book about an extraordinary God using ordinary people to doing ordinary things to achieve an extraordinary outcome. Our ordinary behaviour matters more than we might think. You might think that the things mentioned in this chapter are not particularly important. You know, a woman's faithfulness to her mother-in-law, a man's faithfulness to a refugee, even these two people's faithfulness to the covenant of marriage and one another's sexual purity. None of those things are going to get you great applause. You won't win any awards and no one's really going to praise you. In fact, they might think you're a bit weird. I remember when Jade used to come and stay with me at university, and I'd like deliberately sleep in the front room where she slept in my bed. And everyone I lived with thought this was really weird. Like, why would you do that? But it's important, both because of temptation, but also Romans 14:16. Therefore, do not let what you know is good be spoken of as evil. We should care what people think as well as what actually happens. But God had bigger purposes, didn't he, behind the ordinary faithfulness of Ruth and Boaz here. By reversing the stories of the past, kind of rerunning the situation but with a different outcome, Ruth, the Moabite, is brought back into the people of God. Which I think is why, in a couple of places, Ruth is said to return to Israel. Which is odd, because she's never lived there. But, you know, Lot went out from Abraham, and now Ruth is coming back. This guy, Bajon, concludes, the failures of two great patriarchs, Judah and Lot, are not put right by means of some epic mission or military triumph, but by the means of the faithfulness of two apparently insignificant individuals, Boaz and Ruth. And as a result, their names will be forever remembered in history, and for all the right reasons. Boaz and Ruth could never have dreamt of the eternal consequences of their actions, but their faithfulness allowed the line of Perez to take root in Bethlehem, which would ultimately turn out to be the line from which both David and the Messiah would be born. Because really, this chapter points us to Jesus, doesn't it? We were seeing in Hebrews this week that all of the Old Testament points us to Jesus. Jesus is both our Redeemer and our Husband. We'll talk more about the Redeemer in 2 weeks' time, Sunday morning, chapter 4. But Boaz is Ruth's Redeemer, isn't he? But Jesus is our Redeemer. Like Boaz, he doesn't take advantage of us, and he's willing to redeem us at great cost to himself. He always does the right thing. He cancels out the sins of us and our ancestors. And as soon as we come to him, notice that Boaz has to wait until the next morning, doesn't he? He's not in control. He has to follow the normal process. But as soon as we come to Jesus and ask to be redeemed, he can do it there and then. There's no waiting until morning. You know, the arrangements have already been made. The price has already been paid. Jesus doesn't need to get permission. He can save you then and there. And Jesus is the greater husband. He faithfully does the right thing, even when tempted. But also, he unites himself to us. In the same way that Boaz, being united to Ruth, the foreigner, brought Ruth back into the people, Jesus, uniting himself to us when we were far away from God, brought us back into the people of God. As Ruth became one with Israel through her marriage to Boaz, Gentiles and Jews are now reconciled to God in one body through their union with Christ. In him we inherit, and in him we rest. That's what Naomi was looking for Ruth, and that's what we find through our union with Christ. So for Mrs. Bennett, the solution to her impending poverty as her daughters lay outside of the stability provided by inheritance lay with finding a good husband for her daughter. For Naomi, the solution to her impending poverty as there was nothing for Ruth to inherit lay with finding a good husband for her daughter-in-law. And for us, the solution to our impending disaster is we find ourselves expelled from the line of God's inheritance due to our sin, and with no hope in future, The solution for us is to unite ourselves to Jesus. He will bring us under his wing. He will care for us. He will provide for us. This is a great love story, but there is a greater one. Boaz and Ruth's love was great, but God's love is greater. We'll see more about how it worked in 2 weeks' time when we look at Ruth chapter 4. But for now, we're going to sing, Love Divine, All Loves Excelling. In the second verse it says, Let us all in you inherit. Let us find your promised rest. Ruth found her rest with Boaz. We find our rest with Christ. It's number 714. 714. Love Divine.